I'm just going to get started then. So welcome everyone. Today's talk is on foundation teachings of the Buddha, or basic Buddhism, or Buddhism 101. So a lot of the things I will be talking about in this segment, on my Tuesday segment, will be familiar to many of you. But that's certainly no reason to not be interested in it and not to think it worthy to listen to again and again. One of the things that the Lord Buddha taught was the importance of listening to his teaching again and again, and reciting it even, and committing it to memory and bringing it, calling it to mind again and again. The easiest way to do that is to hear it from someone else, to have someone else explain it. Sometimes, as the Lord Buddha said, sometimes making clear things which were not clear. Sometimes there are aspects which you hadn't heard before. Sometimes there are doubts about the truth or the veracity of the things being said. That can be cleared up by hearing it again and again. And finally, the Lord Buddha said that just by listening to the Dhamma, our mind becomes pure. And if you think of that as the reason why we're practicing Buddhism in the first place, then there's no need at all to even understand what's being said. If your mind is pure at the time when you're listening to the Dhamma, if your mind is clear, and you feel this Dhamma piti, this rapture for the Dhamma, then that's already a wonderful thing and a progress on the path. Something which is, it's already a practice, simply sitting and listening without understanding even. Even animals in the Lord Buddha's time, dogs and birds and frogs, were all able to gain great benefit simply from being around noble people, around monks or around recluses, around meditators. And a lot of us are probably familiar with this with our own animals. If those of you who meditate, you can see that the animals that live with you are able to gain benefit as well, and they become more peaceful, and their character changes based on their interactions with wise and virtuous and meditative people. So today's talk will be on the very core of the Buddha's teaching, and so we're going right back to the basics. I'm just starting with my talks here, so of course I have to start with the basics and slowly get into more diverse subjects. But the very core of Buddhism is the Eightfold Noble Path, and that's what I'll be talking about today. So core is this, it's the first thing that the Lord Buddha taught when he began his ministry, after he became enlightened and made the long journey from the Bodhi tree to the deer park just outside of Varanasi. The first thing he taught to the monks was that they should avoid the extremes. This we've all heard about, avoiding self-mortification and avoiding intoxication with sensual pleasures. And he said by doing so, this is the teaching that he realized, and this is the middle way. And many people misunderstand or don't understand what it was that they aren't even aware that what it was that the Lord Buddha taught as being the middle way. What he said was the middle way on this first day of Buddhism, or the very inception of the Buddhist religion, was that that by avoiding the extremes, one is able to attain the Eightfold Noble Path, which is the middle way. And so it was the first thing. It's also the last thing that the Lord Buddha proclaimed as being the essence of his religion, or the doctrine that he had established, or the ministry that he had set up. And this we know from the passing away of the Lord Buddha. We have this record of a recluse coming to see the Lord Buddha and asking him. He said, "I've been to see all these other recluses, all of these other six teachers that we always hear about in the discourses of the Buddha, and they all claim to be enlightened. And so he asked the Buddha, so what, are all of them enlightened, or are none of them enlightened, or how do I figure out which ones are enlightened or who's enlightened? And this question the Lord Buddha did not answer directly. He said, put that aside for now. Let's not talk about that. Because of course this is something very important in interreligious dialogue, or when you're dealing with other religions. It can be very disastrous even to your own religion, or to your students, or to people who might be interested in your religion, to start bad-mouthing or making even decisive claims about other religions, when you say this religion is bad or that religion is bad, even though your statement might be true. It's generally the case that it's not well received by people who are shopping for religion, so to speak, who are looking around for various practices. It's not considered to be a viable method to propagate one's own teaching. It's something that we try to stay away from, is bad mouthing other, or even making any sort of claim about another religion. So the Lord Buddha didn't do that. Instead, he said, let me put it to you this way. He said, in whatever doctrine, in whatever discipline, in whatever teaching, there is not the Eightfold Noble Path. In that religion, you will not find a samana. And the word samana here, if you've heard of it, we generally translate it as recluse, and that's maybe what it meant before the Buddha came around. But the Buddha's meaning of it was satmana. Mana means mind, and sa is, in this case, means samahita, which is tranquil, or some, like we hear from samati or samatha, which means tranquility. So one who has a tranquil mind, in this case, one who is enlightened. The meaning here is of the Lord Buddha is one who has realized nirvana, who's come to see the truth, and has come to let go of their attachments to the world. So the meaning is, for someone to become enlightened, it has to have a specific path in it, and that is the Eightfold Noble Path. And so he didn't claim this Eightfold Noble Path as being specifically Buddhist. He just said, if someone is missing one of these eight factors, then there's no way that that person could possibly be enlightened. So let's put it that way. If your religion can say that you have these eight qualities, and there are people in your religion that have these eight qualities, then you can be sure that those people, or in your religion, that there are people who have become enlightened. He said, in whatever religion there is the Eightfold Noble Path, this is where you will find a samana. And so we can see this is very, very core, and something that we should go over again and again, and review in our minds, and be clear about in our own practice, and see where we're maybe lacking or deficient or still in conflict with the Eightfold Noble Path, in which part. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I'll just go through them all. I figure I'll take more than half an hour with my talk, and then I'll let everyone ask questions. If it goes over an hour, that's fine by me, but then there's more programs later on in the afternoon, so we'll just have to see how it goes with time. So the Eightfold Noble Path is broken up into three parts. And the first part is wisdom, because this is the fundamental quality of mind that we're trying to cultivate, is wisdom. The second part is morality, and the third part is concentration. And they don't necessarily go in that order, though you can see how it's necessary to start with wisdom, some sort of understanding that something needs to be done. But what happens then is once you develop wisdom, then there arises morality. Once morality arises, then there's concentration. And once concentration is established, then there arises wisdom. And after wisdom, of course, then our morality is more fortified, and so on. So they work together. So starting from the beginning, in the wisdom category, there are two factors, and these are right view and right thought. Right view is considered to be perhaps the base of Buddhism, and this is where we talk about the Four Noble Truths. Right view in Buddhism is simply the understanding of what is suffering, what is the cause of suffering, what is the cessation of suffering, and what is the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. So it's sometimes easy to just skip by this one and say, oh, that's just the Four Noble Truths, and there's not much that needs to be said there. But the profound thing about this statement, that right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, means that it's the discarding of every other view in existence. And this is illustrated in other discourses of the Buddha, like the Brahmajala Sutta, with the 62 different types of view, and the Samadhitti Sutta, and so on. In all of these talks where the Lord Buddha or his disciples were trying to explain what is wrong view and what is right view. And so when we talk about right view, we have to start immediately with wrong view, and it's of course much more important to discuss and to understand wrong view, because right view is something that's fairly familiar with us, and though it's a whole topic in itself, it's very much the practice of the Eightfold Noble Path. Wrong view is of many types. As I said, there's 62, but those 62 even are only dealing with ideas of self. When we talk about wrong view, there are, I suppose, infinite number of wrong views. It just means anything that we hold on to based on belief or based on opinion. And most of them have to do with ideas of self, but it's not limited to that. There's the wrong view that when we die, there's nothing. Or there's the wrong view that when you do good deeds, there is no good result. When you do bad deeds, there is no bad result. The belief that there is no karmic retribution, that when we do a bad deed, it doesn't make us feel bad, and there's no feeling of remorse, and then when we die, then it just disappears, or so on. Or you can do bad deeds and get good result, and you can do good deeds and get a bad result, and so on. There's the view that our mother and father and all of the people who have helped us are not important. It's not important to be thankful or grateful for the things that people have given to us. The idea that there is no such thing as enlightenment, that one cannot become enlightened, and so on. All of these various views, various wrong views of salvation, the idea that salvation can come through blind faith, that it can come about through ritual, simply doing chanting or doing rituals as they did in the Vedas, one can become enlightened. And finally, of course, it does center around the idea of self and the idea of an I, an ego. And it's funny, I've been experimenting with some teachings or just some thoughts on worthlessness. Because I think this is something that comes up very often in the Western world. It's a real problem for us, feeling worthless, feeling like we have no worth and that we are useless or we are substandard. This idea of low self-esteem, and this is considered to be a big deal, and we're always trying to. We're always, everyone can hear me, no? I just got a complaint that I couldn't be heard. Okay, sorry, someone, I think he's got a problem with his audio. I've been trying to explain to people that there's no real problem with feeling worthless, because the whole idea of worth is a completely relative and meaningless in the end sort of estimation. To say that I am worth something, or I have to be worth something, or I have to do something worthwhile, or so on, it really ends up being totally relative. I mean, we're obviously not talking about monetary worth when we say I have worth or I am worth something. So then what really are we talking about? I mean, what am I worth, and what is the value of me, of I? In Buddhism, there's really no concept of this. In Buddhism, we're trying to get rid of the I and the attachment to ego entirely. So really feeling worthless is not a bad thing at all. It's this letting go of ego and the idea that I have to be something, I have to perform. It's letting go of this craving, this need to be, to become, which the Lord Buddha called bhava tanha, the desire to be something. And this is really difficult, I think, for people in the spiritual realm. Most people see spirituality as finding self-worth. And if you ever think of these self-help books where people are selling like hotcakes, how to help people find some self-worth. Well, in Buddhism, this is really not the goal, and it's not the path. And so we could possibly lump this in with all of the wrong views, this idea that we have to find some worth, we have to find some value. And actually what we're trying to do is to let go of the need to have value judgments at all. That when life has its real worth and real value is when we don't place worth and value in any one thing or attach to something as me and mine at all. And so there's no need to find this sense of self-worth. When you feel worthless, you can just use it as a means to let go and say, I don't need to be worth anything. There doesn't need to be an I at all. And living our lives, taking things as they come. Not living our lives trying to live up to some kind of expectation, either expectations we have of ourselves or expectations other people have of us. And so I've been trying to use this as a means to help people to get over these thoughts of worthlessness that I think are quite common. And it's kind of backfired because there's all sorts of people getting upset and saying, what do you mean worthless? We're all worthless. I'm worth something and so on and so on. I mean, kind of thinking of it as in a spiritual way that I have to, you know, value myself and try to overcome these thoughts of low self-esteem. But really, I think the best way to overcome them is to just let go of this judgment. And this ties very directly in with the idea of conceit in the Buddha's teaching. Conceit has to do with us and them, separating into I and you and me and you and yours, separating into us and them, separating into different groups, and looking for our own benefit over the benefit of others, or even looking for the benefit of others over our own benefit, separating into categories. Us is good, them is bad, thinking of yourself as higher than someone and thinking of yourself as lower than someone. Even thinking yourself as equal to someone is considered to be conceit. Whenever you consider yourself to be equal and expect to be treated equal, and when you're not treated equal, then you feel upset. This is also conceit. It's a quality of mind which leads to suffering, because when you're not treated the way you expect to be treated, you have suffering. You are not happy. You get angry. You get upset. So all of these are basically what the Lord Buddha is talking about. He's saying that all of these are wrong view, and anyone who still holds on to these as their understanding of how the world works or how the universe works is still not free from defilement and not free from suffering, which will come to them in the future. That when someone practices meditation, they come to see that really everything that in existence in this world is dukkha. It's something which is not suffering, but it is something which is unsatisfying or uncomfortable, or if you want to give it a good definition, not worth holding on to, a cause for suffering. If we hold on to any single thing in this world, either as good or bad, as me or mine, this is what is the cause of suffering, or that thing will be a cause of suffering for us. So it doesn't mean that an experience in and of itself is painful. There are many very pleasurable experiences in this world or in our lives. But even those experiences are called dukkha. They're called unsatisfying or a cause for suffering. And they're a cause for suffering, one, because they're not permanent. Or they're a cause for suffering, too, because they have to be created, they have to be formed. So pleasant feelings are considered suffering or dukkha because they're subject to change. So one moment we feel happy and then the next moment it disappears. And when it disappears, of course, we're suffering again. We're unhappy because of our attachment to it. Whereas if we had let it be and not given it any value judgment as good or bad, then we would be able to accept the change. But when we hold on to it, we're unable to accept that change, and so it's called suffering. Neutral feelings, this calm and peace which we feel through the practice of meditation often, it's considered suffering because we have to create it, we have to form it, we have to bring it into being. And the more we work at it, the more calm and peaceful we feel. So neutral feelings are considered suffering because they have to be developed or they have to be worked at, they're formed. And when we stop working at it, we lose them. When we lose them because of our attachment to them, we feel suffering, we feel stress, we feel unhappy, we feel unwhole. And suffering feelings are suffering because they are suffering, because they are accompanied with anger and dislike and distress. When we have unpleasant feelings, if we are not careful and understanding, seeing them as they are, then there immediately arises a disliking and anger towards them. And this is a direct cause of suffering. So this is what is meant by right view. When we understand the world in this way, then there's no reason to think of anything as valuable or worthwhile or giving anything any worth. And feelings of worthlessness thus have no power over us. If there arises the idea that I am worthless, then it has no meaning because we don't have any concept of I as this is me and mine and so on. This is the first and the most important thing to get across in Buddhism, with the point being that we're to let go of all views except for a direct understanding of reality as it is. If it's not based on meditation practice and real understanding of the truth, then it's not worth our time to hold on to that as reality, as real. And this we can see as a real problem in Buddhism and outside of Buddhism, or in the world. This ideologies, conflicts of ideology and religion and belief, views that leads people to fight, leads people to war and so on. People who want to live at peace cannot live at peace. So this is an ignoble thing to have wrong view, and thus the Eightfold Noble Path starts with a noble thing, which is right view, or right understanding, which is based on the truth. The number two factor, which is the other part of wisdom, is right thought. And right thought is just means any sort of mental activity or any kind of a reflection on an experience. So when we see or we hear or we smell or we taste or we feel or we think, our reflection on it, how do we reflect on it? What sort of thoughts go through our mind? This is called right thought. And of course, this hinges on right view. If we have wrong view, then we're going to give rise to wrong thought. We're going to give rise to thoughts of sensuality. We see something that we esteem to be beautiful. We hear something that we esteem to be pleasant or harmonious. We smell, we taste, we feel, or we think something that we esteem to be good or pleasant. We then give rise to an attachment and a desire for it. And as we build up that desire, it becomes something dear to us, something that we hold dear. As a result of that, when it disappears, it will be upsetting for us when we don't have it, when we can't have it the way we want, when it changes and so on. We'll also give rise to thoughts of ill will, thoughts of anger. When we see what we esteem to be people, when we see a person and we don't like them, maybe we remember something they did to us, or maybe they're talking loudly, or maybe they smell bad, or maybe they are acting in a way or walking in a way that is upsetting to us, doing things which are upsetting to us, making noise and so on. Then we give rise, because of our misunderstanding of the experience as being a person, a bad person, a loud noise, a bad smell, or so on. then we get upset and we give rise to anger and ill will towards the person, or ill will or anger towards the experience. We'll also give rise to wrong thought in terms of conceit. We'll give rise to thoughts, I'm better than them, I'm not as good as them, I deserve this, I don't deserve that. You hear all of this, it can sometimes be sort of a pseudo-spirituality to believe that I am worthy or I deserve things. And so we get this real kind of a spiritual arrogance where I don't deserve that, I am a person too, I deserve this treatment, or so on like that. And all of these ideas of should be this, should be that, which leads us to oppress and to create suffering for other people, maybe not out of anger, but simply out of arrogance or conceit, or even out of our own low self-esteem, looking at ourselves as not worthy, seeing other people who we esteem to be worthy and feeling sad and angry at ourselves because we're not on their level. So this is all wrong thought. Right thought is the opposite. When we're able to have right view, then of course our thoughts are all pure. Everything we think about, it's only seeing it as it is. So for instance, when you hear me speaking, the mind doesn't give rise to any sort of judgment as liking it or disliking it, or arrogance, maybe thinking that I know more than he does, or maybe even feeling unequal, thinking, oh, he's such a good speaker, why can't I be able to speak like that, or so on. Our mind is able to hear the sound arising and ceasing at the ear. And when we hear the sound arising, we know that it's sound arising. When we hear the sound ceasing, we can know that it's simply that it's the sound ceasing. When we're aware of the meaning of the words, we know that we're aware of the meaning of the words, and we're aware that this is the meaning of these words, without giving rise to liking or disliking. It's a very difficult thing to do. So these teachings are basic, they're certainly not easy. Number three, four, and five are the morality section. And these are pretty basic. I can go through them pretty quickly, and I'll explain how they relate to meditation practice. On a theoretical level, we're talking about the moral precepts. So with right action or with right speech, we're talking about the abstinence from wrong speech, the abstinence from lying, the abstinence from gossiping or backbiting, the abstinence of harsh or rude or speech meant to hurt other people, and abstinence from useless speech, useless chatter, which is of no spiritual benefit. When we can abstain from these four types of speech, this is considered to be right speech. But it doesn't come about just by keeping your mouth closed. It can happen that there's no reason to say something wrong or say something at all, and yet it's not said to be the Eightfold Noble Path. The Eightfold Noble Path is a state of mind that wouldn't say those things. Once we're practicing meditation, even if we did hear or even if we did experience something that would lead us to want to say something wrong, say something bad, we wouldn't. This is considered to be the right speech in this case. Right speech in a positive sense is not the Eightfold Noble Path. It's important to understand this as well. It's not that going out and teaching the Dhamma is considered to be Eightfold Noble Path. It certainly isn't. It's considered to be a spiritual good thing, and it's considered to be a meritorious deed, but it's not the path towards enlightenment. You can't become enlightened by teaching, by saying the right things. We become enlightened through the state of mind, which wouldn't say the wrong things, which is free, and it comes from this right thought, and which comes from right view. It goes in a train. When our mind is in the right place, we would never say these things. So it's included in here that as an indicator of where our mind is, where if we're still saying things which are improper, either by lying or harsh speech or so on, then it's easy to see that we're not yet on the Eightfold Noble Path. The same with right action. Right action is of three parts. This is not killing, not stealing, and not committing adultery, or you could say not cheating, not going against a bargain or an agreement, most especially marriage or or engagement. And again, with right action, we're not simply talking about abstinence. So at the point when there's nothing to kill or nothing to steal, then we're on the Eightfold Noble Path. This isn't the case. And it's better we can use it as a reference point in our practice, that if we're still liable to kill, or if we still have thoughts of killing, wanting to hurt, wanting to harm, if we still have covetous thoughts, wanting to steal other people's things, if we still have the propensity or the ability to steal something with our mind state, then you can see that we're not yet on the Eightfold Noble Path. Or cheating, if we don't see anything wrong with this idea of breaking up someone else's marriage or breaking up our own marriage, then this isn't the Eightfold Noble Path. And number five is right livelihood. And right livelihood here is simply a extension of right speech and right action. Right livelihood in Buddhism doesn't mean you have to become a monk. It doesn't mean you have to abstain from certain types of livelihood, except wherein they infringe upon or they impinge upon the eight precepts. They conflict with the five precepts. When they have to do with killing, when they have to do with stealing, when they have to do with sexual impropriety, when they have to do with all of the kinds of wrong speech, but most especially with lying. There are other types of wrong livelihood which are considered to be wrong in a Buddhist sense and could probably be lumped in here as well. Selling alcohol, selling weapons, selling people, selling animals, and selling poisons. These are also considered to be five things which Buddhists should refrain from. If there are people who sell things, then these are five things that should not be sold by a Buddhist. But again, here we're simply referring to a state of mind that wouldn't be involved with unwholesome states of speech and unwholesome acts of speech, unwholesome acts of body. Once our mind is in that place, we wouldn't do those acts, and as a result, our livelihood is pure. And number 6, 7, and 8, this is referring to the concentration or the meditation portion of Buddhism. And this is sort of the practical aspect, whereas in the beginning we talked about right view, and it's an important thing to sort of accept on an intellectual level, but the intellectual level alone won't get you to enlightenment. That's only the very beginning, which sort of gets us on the path. The path itself is really a meditative path, and so these next three are really the most important from a practical point of view. And the first one is effort. These three just go together. There doesn't have to be a real order. They don't come in some order. But we do need to put out effort in the meditation practice. Enlightenment is not something that's going to come about just by sitting still or just by waiting for it to come or avoiding certain things. Meditation, this is very important. Meditation is an active work that we undertake for the purpose of becoming free from suffering. It's not something where we just sit down, close our eyes, and meditation just creeps over us like Alzheimer's or something. It's totally different from what we would normally consider to be meditation. Normally people think of meditation as a relaxation or a way of taking a break or having a vacation. Meditation in the Buddha sense takes effort. It takes effort to do away with, dispel all sorts of unwholesome and prevent all sorts of unwholesome states of mind, and to develop and to keep and to guard all sorts of wholesome states. So right effort in Buddhism is fourfold based on what I've just said. Any unwholesome qualities of mind which have arisen in our mind, it's the effort to get rid of them, to take them out, to straighten our mind in regards to these, to straighten out a bent mind when our mind is crooked, to develop our understanding and turn our mind around so that we see the experience as it really is and are able to do away with the unwholesome state. And when unwholesome states, if they haven't arisen, then to guard against them. Right effort is this guarding at all times, whether we're standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, to always be guarding, have ourselves, have our minds, our hearts at on guard against these things. It's the development of wholesome states that haven't yet arisen. When we practice meditation, we're trying to change our minds and bring about states of wisdom, states of clarity, states of awareness, states of mindfulness that aren't yet there. And when they have arisen, it's the effort to maintain them, to keep our level of mindfulness on a moment-to-moment basis. Because insight meditation or meditation to see clearly is something that goes from moment to moment. It's not something where we can say we built it up, we had a 10-day retreat, and then after that we came out and everything was good and we could just live our lives as normal. Really what these retreats do for us is they propel us up to a higher state of awareness, which we then have a responsibility to maintain and even bring to higher, yet higher and higher levels. And when we let go and we let it slip, we can very easily fall back to a state where we won't be able to see clearly, where we won't be able to understand things. So effort is very, very important. It's very important to get to this level of effort and energy, and to look at meditation as a work. It's not something that we can just sit down and sit idly by, thinking that somehow we're going to become enlightened as a result. And what do we put effort into doing? We put effort into doing the practice of mindfulness, and this is the next factor, number 7. Right mindfulness. Of course, wrong mindfulness, but we can talk about wrong effort as well. Wrong effort would be pushing ourselves too hard, or putting out effort just for the sake of effort, or it could be even not putting out effort. Wrong effort is laziness. But it's important to talk about wrong effort in terms of pushing yourself too hard as well. There's no benefit to be had from putting out effort just for the sake of putting out effort. The Lord Buddha was very clever in this sense of defining right effort in terms of the reaction and the relationship to wholesome and unwholesome states. That what we're really doing is trying to develop wholesome states and get rid of unwholesome states. Effort that doesn't have to do with this work is considered to be wrong or useless or ignoble effort in terms of a meditative, from a meditative point of view. If we're talking in terms of the world, then of course effort is very, very important, but the effort in meditation is a very different kind. It doesn't mean just effort for the sake of it, or more effort the better. And when we talk about mindfulness, so what is right mindfulness, what is wrong mindfulness? Well, right mindfulness is this recollection or this clear thought, this clear understanding of something as it is in regards to reality, in regards to the present reality. Now, recollection, or the word, of course, the word mindfulness, as I've said before, it is often given, or it is often understood that the word mindfulness is often limited in its explanation of what the word sati really means. Actually, sati has much more to do with memory and remembering or recollection than it does to do with whatever is meant by mindfulness. Though mindfulness might be included as a quality of the word sati, it really means to remember. So, sati in this sense could, if we were talking about wrong mindfulness or wrong sati, then we'd be talking about remembering things from the past or remembering things about the that we have to do in the future. This ability to send the mind and to recall things which have nothing to do with reality, recalling concepts or bringing to mind concepts, thinking about people, being able to remember things that happened a long time ago in the past. This kind of recollection is not good recollection. It's not useful in the meditative sense. Right mindfulness is focusing on or recollecting reality. So when you hear my voice, most of the time you're not really aware, you're not mindful, as we would have to say. You're not mindful of the fact that it's sound. You're not mindful of the sound. You're aware of it as Noah, as the monk, as this teacher, as this guy. You like it or you don't like it. And so the mind has fallen into concepts, which On a worldly level, it's not bad, but in a meditative tradition, we can't use, in a meditative sense, we can't use it. It's not useful for us. In meditation, when we hear sound, we have to be able to see that this is sound arising either, see it for what it is. And this is why we often use this word to remind ourselves, this reminding of ourselves. What is this? This is hearing. So when we hear something, we simply say to ourselves, hearing, 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 reminding ourselves of what it is. When we see something, we say, seeing, seeing, seeing. And you can see how reality changes when you do this, that suddenly there really is only the six senses, the five aggregates, the building blocks of reality. And all of the concepts, they have no room, there's no room for them. There's only an experience of reality as it is. And this I could talk about a little bit more. Maybe I'll wait on Thursday, I'll be talking more about meditation and mindfulness. So here I'll just explain it as this reminding ourselves of things for what they are. This is the meaning of the word mindfulness. And number eight is concentration. Now, concentration is often misunderstood as well. Concentration can often be thought of as this fixed state of mind which knows nothing, sees nothing, hears nothing, and has no thoughts. I've had people complain to me that they've tried meditation, but they can't stop their, they can't attain this thoughtless state, this state where they're perfectly aware, but there's no thinking going on. And so they misunderstand concentration to be some peaceful or quiet state of being where there's no activity going on at all. And as I said, meditation should be thought of as a work, and this corresponds with the Pali word kamatana. Kamatana, kamma means, of course, karma or work or action. In this case, it means work. So what we're doing is actively seeking out these experiences and these realities. When thoughts arise, we're actively trying to understand them. So the act of trying to push them away or keep them out or keep our minds blank is actually counterproductive. It takes us away from reality. It isn't helpful at all. It doesn't allow us to understand the reality that's in front of us, the reality that we're faced with every day. Right concentration is actually focusing on these thoughts or on these emotions or on the conditions as they arise. Whatever arises in the mind, taking it up as an object, even pain. Many people think that pain is a enemy to meditation. It's something that should be avoided at all costs. So we have these wonderful, comfortable cushions that we sit on, trying to adjust our back, adjust our posture to try to escape and to avoid unpleasant sensations and unpleasant experiences. Well, meditation in a Buddhist sense is the exact opposite. It's going in to try to understand these and to see them for what they are. So even when we have pain, we remind ourselves and we want to be able to see it clearly, even if it gets worse, because of course worse is just a judgment call. When we focus and say pain, pain, reminding ourselves that it's only pain, we're able to see it clearly and for once, finally, to come to see that it's simply pain. It's not anything that should be judged as uncomfortable or unpleasant. So that's number eight. Altogether, these eight, as you can see, are very core and very essential to a meditative tradition, a meditative practice. And this is the core of the Buddha's teaching and the core of the path which leads to freedom from suffering. And so the point that should be made is that when we talk about the right path, we're not being arrogant or closed-minded or narrow-minded, trying to say that only Buddhism is the best or there's only one path. What we're saying is that no matter what practice you do and no matter what outward forms the tradition of Buddhism, meditation, or religion take, that at the core they have to have these eight factors in order to be correct, in order to be proper, in order to be right, and in order to be noble in a Buddhist sense. So rather than say that my tradition is the best or this tradition is the best, we can simply put it out there that if you're missing one of these eight factors, then by our standards, there's something wrong with your meditation practice. You don't have to become more like, you don't have to follow our tradition, but what you're going to be faced with then is problems based on that lacking from our point of view. And this is the Buddhist point of view and the Buddhist understanding of reality and the path which leads to the understanding of reality and to freedom from suffering. So that's the talk that I have to give to you all today. Thanks for coming out. I hope it's been useful. And I can take questions now. Or comments. In the idea of karmic law, is it something that happens internally? Yeah, and externally. I mean, when we do something, it sends ripples out into the universe. When I give this talk, it changes all of you, and maybe you like me better, or maybe you don't like me, and you'll react accordingly. And so it is internal and external. I mean, it's every reaction has an opposite reaction. I mean, this isn't a physical law only, it's a mental law as well. When we act out of anger, it has internal consequences and external consequences. Other people react accordingly. So karma is just a law of nature. And I think I'm going to give another talk about this in the near future, talking about how I understand the laws of nature to not only apply to the physical. And I think this is important in a Buddhist sense, that we apply these sort of reactive laws and show that they are actually applicable to the mental part of the universe. That when you do something physical, energy is only transferred. Well, the same goes with the mind. When you give rise to a mental thought, it doesn't disappear. The consequences cannot just become void. It's like a web. This is, people talk about conditionality or dependence, interdependence. You're welcome. But yeah, the best way to understand karma is internally. That's the most obvious. People who do lots of bad things, it really changes who they are, and that's why when we understand about things like rebirth or the idea that death is only a concept or so on, that karma becomes essential to our Buddhist or a very important part of our Buddhist practice. Like, whoa, if I'm not careful, well, it doesn't just end when you die. But of course, that's another issue, another subject. What function do you think SL can play in Buddhist practice? I'm still kind of skeptical about Buddhist practice in Second Life. For me, it's much more useful, as I think is quite obvious, for spreading the teaching and having people bring it back into real life. I'm still reserving judgment on the idea of actually practicing here in Second Life, and I think a lot of people are skeptical. Because when you're sitting in front of your computer screen, there are often diversions, sort of you peeking and looking to see what other people are doing. I don't know if there's a great benefit that comes from, say, group practice. Maybe there is. It looks like there are quite a few people involved in it. I guess I don't have judgment either way on that. I think it's best, from what I've seen, it's incredibly useful as a teaching tool. Aren't the diversions kind of like pain as it comes to meditation? Yeah, no, I just think people, you know, don't take it seriously. I guess that's all. And I've heard people talking about that, how, you know, they're sitting in meditation, but they're not really paying attention to the present moment. They're kind of, you know, thinking about what other people are doing, or I don't know. I mean, obviously you can meditate in front of the computer screen. I just wonder whether it's more beneficial than, say, going off into a quiet room and meditating. Or I am, or getting IMs, or getting notices, or what was it that Faith was telling me about? People sending you dance scripts. I'm not sure that it's actually more useful than solitary practice. I guess the idea is that, like a Dharma group, it's a chance to come together. It's an incentive to meditate. So maybe it is. I'm not sure about that myself. I'm not decided either way. Well, thanks for coming. You mentioned SL as a sort of model of reality in an earlier talk. Yeah. Yeah, except it doesn't have body, it doesn't have the physical. And in meditation, we always start with the physical. So in terms of actually practicing in Second Life, I think it's always going to be much more of an intellectual exercise, or it may be much more intellectual exercise. In meditation, we're always starting with the physical, and that's how we come to understand. Because the mental is very hard to catch. I guess that's the point. If we just start looking at our mind, it doesn't really allow us that kind of observation as the body does. So like walking meditation, obviously, it'd be useless to do walking meditation in Second Life. Although I have considered trying to demonstrate it in Second Life. When I first came into Second Life, I said, cool, I'm watching myself meditate. That's so absurd. How do you close your eyes? My eyes are always open. Yeah, but my character's eyes are always open. Why are they open? Shouldn't our eyes be closed? Thanks. Let me know. In Second Life, there's not much more but your mind to observe. Oh, indeed. I mean, you can use Second Life as a meditation. I don't doubt that at all. And I'm just reserving my judgment as to whether it's going to enhance our practice or not. Obviously, it does in terms of listening to teachings and having a chance to discuss and meet with teachers or meet with fellow practitioners. But apart from that, I don't know. I mean, there's the other side is that it's eye candy. And when we see all these beautiful and wonderful things, this can be a cause for attachment. And I guess that's why I'm most hesitant to pass judgment in a positive sense. And then all the ugly things that make us angry and want to throw people around. Yeah, I hope it's clear that I am keeping an open mind and I haven't passed judgment either way. I just haven't passed judgment saying, yeah, SL is a great thing, a great tool for meditating and so on. Nice frog. I'm happy to give whatever I can. And thank everyone for coming. I guess we'll just stop there.